Hello, and welcome to the 73rd edition of the House of Comments podcast. My name is Emma Burnell, and I blog at Scarlet Standard, which is a Labour-supporting blog. And I'm joined today by my usual co-host, Mark Thompson, from his own blog, which is a Lib Dem-supporting blog. And we've been having a nice summer off. Hopefully you've enjoyed the special one-off podcast that we did with interviews with ourselves and some very, very interesting people. But here we are back. It's the number 73, so I'll be whizzing around the house with my skates on trying to make sandwiches.
I'll
that's
be
a reference
paint.
for those of a very particular age.
I'll be painting strange pictures in the corner.
Excellent, excellent. And we've got Kajagoogoo in the basement.
Indeed.
There are a huge swathe, I hope, of listeners who have no idea what we're talking
I
about here.
reckon about two people will get
Well, they're our core audience, so it's all good.
it.
So we thought we'd start off by covering some of the stories that have happened over the summer that we haven't shared the excitingness of our wisdom on because we've been on holiday. It's obviously been one of the biggest stories over the summer has been the arrest of David Miranda, who is the partner of Glenn Greenwald, and has been involved in some way or another in his work in exposing the secrets from the NSA that were exposed by Edward Snowden. There are two stories that seem to be rather connected. The arrest and 9-hour detention under terrorism laws of Mr. Miranda, and also revelations that a month or so before that, the security services had sent, at the behest of the government, people to the offices of the Guardian to smash up various hard drives containing data. Mark, you've just come back from Canada, one of our many allies in the war on terror. Was there much coverage of that over here, over there, or was this a local story?
Well, to be perfectly honest, I didn't watch that much Canadian television when I was over there. Managed to catch America's New Top Model Boys versus Girls a couple of nights before we left. But
Very topical.
the coverage of civil liberties on that was minimal, I have to say. I was sort of keeping in touch with what was happening in the UK just via kind of Twitter and blogs and stuff, but I tried to keep that to a minimum because I was supposed to be on holiday. But I can't help myself. I did still dip in and out. So I don't really know what their view on it was, but I mean, my view is, well, first of all, isn't it great to have Lib Dems in government now so that this sort of thing can't happen anymore? I'll just get that in there quickly before you do, Emma. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's absolutely dreadful. I think the fact he was held for 8 hours and 55 minutes, when apparently something like 0.06% of people who are held under this particular law were ever held for more than about 6 hours. So it really did seem to be that the security services were sending some sort of message via this arrest to Glenn Greenwald, and maybe Edward Snowden as well. It really felt like state bullying and intimidation to me. That was my initial reaction as soon as I heard this story. As I reflected on it more, I started to think maybe it's not that. Maybe it's that because his ticket, David Miranda's ticket, was bought by The Guardian, that they thought that he might be transporting things that, were of national security interest. But my understanding is that the law that he was stopped under is specifically to do with terrorism. And I don't think that there is really anyone who could credibly argue that they thought that David Miranda was a terrorist. So it's one of these laws that I think was already drafted quite loosely. I know that Lord Falconer wrote a piece for The Guardian a week or so ago where he claimed that it was outside of, it had been used incorrectly, and the way it had been used was outside the bounds of how it was originally intended. I have to say I got a little bit irritated because when I started reading the specific sections, it did seem like there is a way you could interpret the law and argue that it was used correctly because it is pretty loosely worded. And I have to say that that is kind of typical of this sort of security legislation. I don't think it's an accident that things are worded like that. I think it's deliberate to give the security forces levity and to be able to use these things in pretty much any way that they want. But I think that the whole episode of his detention and the fact he was held for so long, I don't really understand what the security services thought they were going to achieve with this because I think it's pretty badly backfired. And the fact that you've now got Keith Vaz and and various other MPs onto this and talking about how, you know, that people need to be brought to, you know, brought in front of MPs to explain themselves and explain what's happened here and the massive furore that it's caused. I think they've shot themselves in the foot. I think just in terms of the whole smashing up of the hard drives thing, that seemed to me to be absolutely ridiculous. It didn't seem to serve any purpose at all other than to make it look like you've got jackbooted thugs from the government coming down to the Guardian offices to smash up equipment. You know, if they were trying to, you know, if they were trying to paint a picture of themselves as some kind of Orwellian, you know, horrible nightmare situation, they couldn't really have done a better job, really, I think. It and also, what's absolutely crazy about that is apparently there were 6 copies of what was on those hard drives in existence, and smashing up those 2 hard drives just destroyed 1 copy, apparently. Now, if I was one of the people in possession of one of those other copies in whatever countries they're held in, my first instinct would be to think, I better take some more backups of these just in case. So the idea that smashing up 1 copy has increased security because now there's only 5, as Dan Hodges seemed to think, I reckon there's now 15 or 30 or 60. I don't think people who are thinking that way really understand how people who are in possession of precious data that can be pretty easily and quickly copied perfectly will react under situations like that. So if anything, I think they've put themselves in a more dangerous position if they're worried about the data proliferating and there being leaks.
I completely agree. I mean, it is going back to what you were saying about the way that it makes the government look. I mean, I think your party has a particular problem with this because more than anything else, you have a role in government to look a certain way and to be pursuing a certain agenda. I mean, I'm going to give you some quotes here. This will be a government that will end the culture of spying on its citizens, a government that will introduce safeguards to prevent the misuse of anti-terrorism legislation, a government that is proud when British citizens stand up against illegitimate advances of the state. Those quotes all come from Nick Clegg's first speech as Deputy Prime Minister.
Yeah.
Can any of those be held up now as the way that the Lib Dems are indeed behaving in government?
Well, I don't think they can. It is lamentable, really, that we're in this sort of situation. I mean, seeing the reaction of... Well, first of all, my understanding is that Clegg wasn't even told that this was happening until after it had happened. So he was already...
I think he's claimed that he did know about the smashing up of the drives. He didn't know about the David Miranda.
Yeah, so we're conflating 2 different things here. You're right, he did know about the drive smashing, and maybe we'll come to that separately in a minute. He didn't know about the David Miranda thing before it happened. I mean, in a way, maybe that's fair enough, because that was probably an operational decision taken very quickly. And I suppose, I think the Prime Minister was informed, but I suppose they can't be ringing around half the government to let them know what's happening before they do it. So I can sort of understand that, but it does mean he was on the back foot immediately. It actually reminded me a little bit of what happened a couple of years ago when Cameron employed his veto in quotes. And I don't think Clegg was consulted about that either. I think he just had to react to that off the hoof immediately. And I have seen one of the things that that some Lib Dem activists and bloggers, commentators have said is that Nick Clegg doesn't... I've seen it described as he's not an instinctive liberal, he's an intellectual liberal. So his knee-jerk reaction to things isn't always liberal, or at least it isn't liberal enough for quite a lot of Lib Dems, I think. But when he sits down and thinks about something and then, you know, mulls it over, the decision he usually then comes to is usually quite liberal. And I think some people have a problem with that they would prefer there to be an instinctive liberal leading the Lib Dems rather than someone who has to kind of mull it over and weigh it up. And I suppose in his defence, being in the position of Deputy Prime Minister, you know, perhaps if he did knee-jerk everything, that wouldn't be good either for other reasons. But I don't think that you can really reconcile any of those quotes that you've just said to me with what's happened in this particular case. And it's a big problem, because you're absolutely right. What difference are the Lib Dems making? I mean, what's happened here? Let's be honest. If this had happened under a Labour government, Lib Dem activists would be furious. We'd have gone apeshit. And Clegg would have done as well. Clegg would have been all over the media saying how terrible this was. And instead, he's doing pretty much the exact opposite. Well, he has said that he wants to wait to see what the inquiry says. But, you know, if he was in opposition, he definitely wouldn't have said that. And it does make it look like the Lib Dems in government are complicit in this stuff. And it really does make me question what difference the Lib Dems are making, because I can't really see. In this case, I cannot see what difference they've made.
So given that, I mean, I know that you had a long, dark night of the soul back when secret courts were being discussed and your party membership was overridden by your party leadership in terms of their support for that. I'm going back to a post that you wrote back in June where you said there were certain scenarios that you could imagine leading to you leaving the party. I'm just wondering how much worse it has to get.
Yeah, I don't know if you listened to the interview that I did with Karen Lindsay from Lib Dem Voice that we released as one of the podcasts over the summer. It was a fairly lengthy discussion that we had, and that did come up actually about my, because what I said was that I was going to not campaign for any MP that had voted for secret courts or any, and if it came to a candidate who's not currently an MP, I would ask them, what would you have done? And, you know, and if they would have voted against, I'd campaign for them. But if they'd have voted for, I wasn't willing to campaign. And her point was, which I think as a long-term activist yourself, Emma, you might have some sympathy with. She said that as far as she was concerned, though, she would rather have a Lib Dem MP in than, you know, a Labour MP or a Conservative MP. And so therefore she didn't see the point in not even for MPs who had voted for secret courts, that she would still campaign for them because she'd rather see a Lib Dem in. And I think if that she was on the other foot and this was a Labour situation, maybe you would have sympathy with that view.
Sympathy with that view. I understand my own tribalism. I'm questioning yours.
Yeah. Well, I've argued with you on many occasions that I'm not a tribalist. I suppose I have a fairly narrow definition of tribalism in that I consider that to be the kind of, you know, my party right or wrong type thing, and where you see people who will argue one case and then when their party changes the view, the leadership changes the view, suddenly they're arguing the opposite case or a very different case to what they were arguing previously. That irritates me. I try to be consistent as far as I can. I mean, I guess what you're getting at is, am I going to leave the party over this? No, I'm not. I haven't really had as long a dark night of the soul over this as I had over secret courts. Maybe it's because I was in another country and I was largely focusing on being on holiday, and so I've not perhaps pored over this as much as I did secret courts. And also, of course, there was the conference vote where, you know, conference very clearly said no, and then the party did it anyway, and that all happened in very quick succession. So there was a very clear slap down to the membership under those circumstances. In this case, there's not been a specific slap down to the membership. But we have our conference in 2-3 weeks' time anyway. And I think it will be interesting to see what happens there, because I'm sure I'm not the only member who is pretty furious about this. And it will be interesting to see what happens. I expect that whatever conference does won't make that much difference as we've seen in the past. But, and I'll be very interested to speak to lots of other members and you know, get the temperature of what everyone else thinks about this.
So what are the scenarios that you could imagine that would lead you to leaving the party?
Am I allowed to invoke the I don't answer hypothetical questions answer that most politicians would use?
I don't think you like that when most politicians use it, do you?
I definitely don't like it when other politicians use it. It's a tough question. I'll know it when I see it, I suppose, is the only way that I can answer that. I mean, maybe it would be when I think that the party is doing more harm than good. And at the moment, I don't think that's true. I think the party is doing more good than harm. But certainly episodes like this tip those scales more in the harm direction. So, you know, it's going to be a cumulative thing. And eventually, maybe the balance will tip and I'll have had enough. It hasn't happened on this occasion. And you know, we will wait and see what happens with the inquiry. You know, maybe we'll get to a point where the inquiry heavily criticises security services, and then maybe we'll see Lib Dem ministers come out very heavily for reforms. I don't know. We will have to wait and see on that.
OK, well, I'm sure we'll return to this. On the question of doing more harm than good, was the £120,000 or so that the Lib Dems got from the will of an old lady worth the reputational damage it caused them?
It was 99,000.
There you go.
And something. OK, so this was her name was Joan Edwards, and she died. I think it was it a couple of years ago that she died, or a year ago?
It's a while ago. I mean, things always take forever.
Yeah. And what she'd specifically said in her will was that she wanted her estate to go to whichever government is in power on the date of my death to do with as it sees fit, or words. The second part of that is words to that effect, but the first part of it, I'm pretty sure, is right, because that's what's caused all the controversy. Because what then happened was that the executors apparently told the government that she had left the money to the parties, or parties in government, obviously, because it's a coalition. And then the Conservatives and the Lib Dems focused on how to divide it up, and they came up with some formula whereby the Tories got about 80% and the Lib Dems got about 20%. So that's why the Lib Dems ended up with just less than 100,000 and the Tories ended up with about 420,000, I think it was. Now, the controversy has been caused because when the actual wording of the will was looked at, and I think it was the Mail that broke this story, the wording actually specifically said government. It didn't say party. And it's pretty common for people to leave money to the government, in other words, the Treasury. I think it's less common for people to leave money to parties, but it's pretty much unprecedented for someone to leave money to whichever party happens to be in government, because that's quite a random thing. And I remember when the story first broke, before the controversy side of it, when people were just saying that, you know, it had been left to the party in government, that did seem quite weird. I think I first saw it on Lib Dem Voice when Stephen Tall wrote a post about it. The thing that really irritated me about this story, though, is that as soon as the news came out that it said government rather than party, then both the Conservatives and the Lib Dems immediately said they'd give the money to the Treasury, which is fair enough. I don't really think there's anything else they could have done under those circumstances. But within a few hours of that, the executors came out and said, no, she meant party. She definitely meant party. I think the executors and the solicitors, who I think are the same people, did a very poor job of making sure that the drafting of the will was correct in that case, because we've only got their word to go on now that that's what she meant. If you read the wording of the will, it says government. But the really weird thing is that it says whichever government is in power at the time of my death. Now, you could imagine a situation where a government was in power and then she died, and then by the time the will was read and all the legal stuff was sorted out, a different government was in power. So it would have been impossible to fulfil her will if she didn't mean party. So there was some ambiguity there. But the thing that irritated me is that the coverage of this in a lot of the press was how the Conservatives and Lib Dems had stolen this money, as if they'd connived to steal money that was meant for the government. And I don't think that's what happened here at all. I think what happened is they were told by the executors it was meant for the parties. They said, OK, well, we'll work out a formula. And then as soon as it came out, no, it's not parties, it's government, they said, fine, we'll give it to the Treasury then. I don't really think the parties have done anything wrong here except try to follow what the executors told them was going on.
I think the parties were bloody stupid. I mean, they weren't illegal. They weren't. I don't think they were stealing anybody's money. I think they weren't thinking very carefully about what the impact of accepting this particular donation worded in this particular way. And when you are given a donation, I know this because we had one when I was running a small organisation, CIRA, which is a political organisation, you see what the wording is, you know, when you're given notice that you're going to get the money. Mm. So if I'd seen that, I would have thought, if I had any nous, which I like to think I do, that's going to cause me huge, huge reputational damage. I don't want to touch it with a barge pole, build a bloody school.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I'm suspicious about whether they did see the wording, because I agree with you. I think if I was in the position of, you know, the person who
someone saw the wording, because it's part of the legal process.
Well,
I say, when I had this very situation at CIRA, we were given a copy of the will while it was in the whole probate situation was being sorted out.
Yeah, I mean, I've read a lot of comments on this, because there was a massive comment thread underneath a couple of the Lib Dem Voice posts. And I think I read some comments on some other, might have been one or two of the papers as well. And the jury's out on that. I don't think it is always the case that the wills are given. Certainly there was some people saying that there are cases where that doesn't happen or hasn't happened. So I don't know. Maybe it was, maybe it wasn't. If it was, I think I'd probably agree with you that they should have been more careful. But I think there was a distraction here, because the focus was on how do we divvy this money up, and the executors had told them she intended it for the parties. You know, the executors have been very, very clear about that. So the wording might have been dodgy, but the executors were very clear. And I think if someone contacted me and said, someone's left you a load of money, you know, and the executor said they have left, I mean, I would read the will. And if I think there was any ambiguity, I'd be thinking, OK, are you sure this is meant for me? But, you know, like I say, they were very, very clear. So if anyone's cocked up here, it's them, not the parties. And yet the vast majority of people who now, when they think back in a year or two or three's time about this story, it will be, oh, yeah, remember when the Tories and the Lib Dems stole that money from that woman? That's how people will remember this story now. And I don't think that's fair.
Well, it's fair because they cocked up the public perception of it because they weren't careful enough before accepting the money.
Well, as soon as it became clear, literally within like an hour or two, they just gave the money back. And I don't think they were clear. I think it was cock up rather than conspiracy.
Well, yeah, but they did cock up very, very badly. And that's the point I'm getting at, is that they messed up the politics of this. They got neither the money nor the reputational advantage of not taking the money.
I think I don't know whether the full details of this will ever come out. Maybe I'll have to wait for memoirs or something. I think what this episode has actually done, it's kind of highlighted how just whatever situation the parties and government finds itself in, there are lots of people in this country who will immediately, instinctively just assume the worst of, you know, the worst motives of politicians, the worst motives of people in government. And also a lot of the commentary about this was about how terrible it is that, you know, this money's just going to be wasted on politics, on politicians, on their whims. And it's like, I mean, it speaks to the broader question about how our politics is funded, because it almost seemed to be the default assumption was spending money on politics and political campaigning is a waste of money, and there's far better things that money can be spent on. And as if this woman would have meant the money to have been given to parties. Obviously, she meant it was given to the Treasury. Well, actually, that's not necessarily right, is it? Lots of people give money to political parties, and having healthy democracy where parties are funded well enough to be able to argue and campaign in the way that they want to shouldn't be seen as such a terrible, terrible, nasty, you know, slimy thing. It isn't. It doesn't have to be like that. But the prism that this episode was filtered through was riven with that kind of imagery. And I just think that
Absolutely.
Says a very
but
bad
where
thing
do you
about
think
our
that's
politics.
Come from, Mark? Because I think quite a lot of that has come from the two parties who are now forming the government, attacking things that were happening under the last government. So, for example, union funding.
Yeah, well, I my view on union funding, and I think that trying to... I think what Ed Miliband's done is very brave. And I said that, you know, I really do think that, you know, he's cutting off a significant source of funding to his party. And I think the Tories have to respond in kind and accept that there has to be some sort of cap. But I don't think that the cynicism of politics started 3 and a bit years ago. I think this has been going on for decades. And I think it is partly...
I think the cynicism has been around for a long time. It's just that you're on the receiving end now rather than the giving end.
Yeah, but if this episode had happened when Labour was in government, and you'll just have to take my word for this, I'd have been as furious as I am with the fact that it's the Tories and Lib Dems in government. Because I would have been, because I don't think most Labour politicians are in... in public life in order to get what they can out of it. I don't think that at all.
That's a different question. This isn't about the individuals making money. This is about parties taking money from sources that we aren't all clear on whether we agree with those sources being able to fund politics.
Yeah, but when I said about, you know, it speaks to this broader question, that's what I'm talking about. Because I think most people, when they hear, oh, yeah, the parties are getting the money, they think that these MPs are just taking the money and going and having a massive piss up somewhere. The narrative and the debate around this is all about how this money is just wasted. And, you know, and I think we can have a legitimate argument about whether the way money is spent during election campaigns is effective and is right. But the idea that, funding political parties is somehow dirty and wrong, and really most people, most right-thinking people wouldn't ever think that someone could want to donate to parties, you know, because that has been the tone of this debate. And it's just, what I said earlier on about how people will remember this episode, that's just depressing, because it'll make people less likely to donate to parties for a start. And I don't think that's a good thing. I think, you know, I think it's good that people should donate to political parties if they want to.
Moving forward to a story that's coming up and very much part of this further debate, the government, just before it broke up for the summer, published the Lobbying and Transparency Bill.
Okay.
And it now appears that lobbying and transparency means stopping anybody from voicing dissent in the year running up to an election. There are significant concerns from charities, from blogs, and from organisations whose role it is to try and push policy, that they will be stymied by this. It could put Labour List, Lib Dem Voice, Conservative Home out of business. It could stop any charity from being able to campaign in the run-up to election in the way that we've seen charities do in the past. It could stop For example, the British Heart Foundation, the National Housing Associations, anybody who has a view on what the policies of the next government, from being able to express that in the run-up to the next election. It's an absolute dog's dinner of a piece of legislation, and it is, you know, completely Orwellian. And I don't use that term often because it's overused in politics, but to have taken a situation where there was concern about lobbying and use it to stifle dissent is quite extraordinary. Even the Electoral Commission have come out and said, you know, this is completely unworkable. Yet this has been put through by the government and is being absolutely rushed through. It was published just before summer recess, and the idea is that it will have its second reading on the 3rd of September.
Mm. So you'd have to forgive me slightly because I'm not really up to speed with this, but from what you've said there, I would have to agree with you. I think you've got two ends of a spectrum here, haven't you? So if I think back to the 2004 US presidential campaign, when John Kerry, who was a decorated war hero, was absolutely trashed by a so-called independent, in quotes, group of former military boatmen called the Swift Boat Veterans for Justice, who basically trashed his reputation, accused him of lying and all sorts of stuff. And I think that, I don't know if that was what caused John Kerry to not win the presidential election in 2004, but it must have had an effect, you know, because what the Republicans were able to do through that lobbying group was able to take what was probably John Kerry's strongest point and turn it into a big negative for him. Now, I know that's a different country and it was several years ago.
It's a different country. It's not something that's happened here.
Sure.
So why are we writing legislation?
Absolutely. What I'm saying is that there's an extreme end of a spectrum where if you just literally had anyone able to say anything that they wanted, you could have a situation like that. I mean, I don't think we're in that sort of situation. I think, you know, if I think back to like the AV campaign, you know, I think there were some things that were said and done during that campaign that I think were just wrong, you know, were factually wrong. And, you know, there wasn't time and there wasn't a way for things that were being said to be redressed properly. But I don't really see how this would help that either, because I don't think that this would affect things that happened during a referendum campaign. So, I think the idea that you're going to end up in a situation where, you know, party blogs or party supporting blogs could be closed down. I was reading something where it might be that, you know, Nick Clegg could decide that Lib Dem Voice would have to close down. Nick Clegg shouldn't have any say about whether Lib Dem Voice closes down or not. That's none of his business. Likewise, Cameron with Conservative Home or Ed Miliband with Labour List. It does seem very strange. Because I don't know the details of this, I don't know, but I do wonder if there's a bit of law of unintended consequences thing going on here, where it's just been drafted in a very woolly way, and maybe things will be tightened up. But my fear is that these things are never properly tightened up anyway. And the amount of times I've seen ministers come to the dispatch box and say, no, but this legislation won't be used in that way because that's not what's intended. And then 6 months or a year or 3 years later, you see that that's exactly what it's been used for. And just because a minister said that's not what it's intended for doesn't mean it won't be used for that once it's been, been voted on and comes into law. So, yeah, this kind of thing worries me quite a lot.
So we've got secret courts, people having their hard drives smashed up, people being arrested and held for 9 hours under terrorism legislation when they're not suspected of terrorism, and the silencing of third-party groups. Coming back to your first line, Mark, it's great to see the influence of the Lib Dems in government.
Yeah, well, I refer the Honourable Lady to the reply I gave some moments ago. I've not decided in the last 10 minutes I'm going to leave the party. But, you know, we'll have to wait and see what happens about this. At the moment, my understanding is it's draft legislation, so we'll have to see what happens further down the line. But yes, if this is another one of those things that tilts things more in the harm direction, you know, it's going on those scales.
And one more further thing that tilts things on the harm legislation, and I think this is interesting in terms of lobbying, because, you know, one of the things that I was very heavily involved with was lobbying around the bedroom tax.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of what was said beforehand was, you know, here is the impact of the bedroom tax. The impact bedroom tax will cost government more because you will force people out of low rent social housing that has a third bedroom that they're not using into higher rent private housing. And lo and behold, the cost of welfare is set to soar by at least $1.5 billion as a result of the bedroom tax. And, you know, if those people aren't allowed to make those points to the government before an election, the government could just pass any random legislation it wanted because it's got no dissent.
Yeah, I mean, when we've talked about this before, I have agreed with you. I mean, my view on this has been right from the start that, in principle, the idea of more efficiently distributing the housing stock in this country is a good thing. But in practice, this always looked unworkable, and so it has proven, because there just aren't the houses. It's not like every time someone who, you know, has got a three-bedroomed house and whom councils or the government want to move to a two-bedroomed house says, OK, well, we'll move to a two-bedroomed house. Apparently 95% of the time, there isn't a house for them to move to. So this is effectively a mandatory, I'm not going to call it tax, because it isn't a tax, but, you know, a mandatory reduction in the amount of money that people are getting, and there's nothing they can do about it, which is ridiculous. And the fact that it's cost them more doesn't really surprise me, because... you know, because of all the bureaucracy and everything that's involved with it. I keep hearing about these cases, and at first I was getting a little bit irritated with some of these anecdotal stories, because, you know, there's always going to be extreme cases whenever you change rules about something. But I think there's just too many of them. There's just too many of these apparent anomalies, you know, situations where you've got someone whose house has had £20,000 spent on it in order to adapt it to, you know, to fit in with whatever equipment they need for their particular disability. And then they're made to move to another house where £20,000 is going to have to be spent again to adapt that house. There's just too many situations like that. It's one of these things that in principle sounds, you know, like the man in the street, oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, we should make sure that the houses are all distributed properly. You know, and it sounds OK, but actually in practice, it is just totally unworkable. And the more I think about it, the more I'm wondering if this will ever be workable, even if we had a perfectly functioning economy and everything was great and, you know, we had loads of money to spend. I still wonder whether this would be the right thing to do, because I'm not sure this will ever be practicable.
Not as far as I can see. And, you know, there's so many other considerations when it comes to the kind of homes that people live in and the kind of communities that people who own clusters of housing, like a housing association or a council, are trying to build. And there's, you know, there's a lot more to it than just putting people into specifically sized boxes.
Yeah, I think that there's an interesting political angle to this, though, because I think that Labour, either they have done or they're going to come out and say that they will repeal what they call the bedroom tax. Is that correct? Have they said they're definitely going to, or do you think it's just very likely that they will?
I think it's just very likely at the moment. Yeah. We're not close enough to the election to make those markers yet.
Yeah. So
given the amount of noise that has been made,
it would be incredible. I'd
be very surprised if we didn't.
Yeah. So I think that your party will decide to go into the election campaign, campaigning to repeal this legislation. And I think that will put the Lib Dems in a very interesting position, because I think the Lib Dems would quite like to repeal it as well, but they've been part of the government that's, you know, that's introduced it. So I think if you can imagine a putative, you know, if there's a hung parliament, you can imagine a putative coalition negotiation between the Lib Dems and Labour. I imagine they'd spend 5 seconds on this, because I don't think there'll be any question about it. That will just be one of these ones where they'll say, yeah, fine, yeah, we'll get rid of that. But that will be a strange position for the Lib Dems to be in, having been in part of the government that actually introduced it. So, and I don't imagine this will be the only thing that will happen on. I imagine there will be a number of things that Labour will either do differently or may even decide to do the exact opposite of what this government's done. And perhaps the majority of those things are things that Lib Dems will instinctively agree with them about. So I'm not sure what that's going to do for the reputation of politics or the Lib Dems when it comes to that point, because, you know, I could imagine if the Lib Dems went into the next election saying that they were going to abolish tuition fees like they did last time, that would just make them an absolute laughingstock. Even if a coherent ideological and political argument could be made for it, the idea that the Lib Dems could ever campaign on that again is just ludicrous. And so I wonder where the Lib Dems will actually be on questions like this, where something may have gone through, perhaps through gritted teeth, or however you want to characterise it, and yet they want to do the opposite. They're almost going to have to campaign against their own record on some of these things. Could make for a very interesting 2015 election campaign.
Yeah, and I think it does make it a lot harder for the Lib Dems to choose to be equidistant. And a lot harder for the Lib Dems to see themselves allying with Labour, were Labour to become the largest party, for that very reason. And then their reputational damage, you know, well, they'll be harmed either way last time, but you know, there's nothing they can do. If they can either do the democratic thing and, you know, make a decision beforehand and announce it and say, we'll go with whoever wins the most seats or most votes or what have you. Or, and, you know, if that's Labour, and I hope and believe it will be, suffer the consequences of having to go back on a great deal of what they've done in government. And, you know, the other problem, of course, is that those Lib Dems who have stayed in the party, not all, but a lot of them are economically those who feel more comfortable with the Conservative government. You know, that's a very difficult place for them to be.
I'm not sure that's quite right. There are still a lot of people in the party who would describe themselves as kind of social liberal. I think there's this idea that, you know, kind of 90% of the social liberals have left, and what we're left with is a, you know, a tiny rump of social liberals completely dominated by economic liberals. That doesn't fit with what I'm seeing at all. I mean, some have left, yes, of course, but there's still
some have left. But I, party numbers have gone down considerably. And it's, you know, to be expected that that's probably people who are less happy with your behaviour in government.
Yeah, I'm not saying there's not been an effect, but I don't think it's as dramatic as a lot of people think. I think, you know...
Although I hear you have one new member. Apparently, Steve Webb claims that God is a Lib Dem.
Yeah, I wondered if you'd find a way to get that in. I only just noticed that about half an hour ago. Well, who knows? I'm not sure I can comment on that, to be honest.
Well, you know, God is a Lib Dem. That's, yeah, it's an interesting concept.
It reminds me of, I think,
maybe, you know, one of them's the Father, one of them's the Son, and the God is, and one of them's the Holy Ghost.
All right, so we got the Holy Trinity of political parties then.
Yeah.
I remember just before the 1997 election, Tony Blair got into quite a lot of hot water because he claimed that it was his religion, his religious beliefs, that led him to join the Labour Party in the first place. And I remember there was a big hoo-ha about that because, you know, the Tories were complaining that he was effectively saying that if you're religious, then you can't be anything other than Labour. I think it's a pretty dodgy thing for politicians to get involved with. I think Alistair Campbell was pretty much spot on. You know, we shouldn't do God, really.
Yeah, no, I mean, I agree. Although there are a lot of movements through religion into politics. But that happens across the board. I mean, yeah, there are Christian socialists and there are very right-wing Christians. And, you know, it's both of whom would say that their politics are motivated by their religious beliefs.
I would say, if anything, there's probably more religious people in a party like the Tories than there are in the Lib Dems or Labour. I mean, that's just off the top of my head. I don't have any statistical facts to back that up.
I have never been in a CLP where there wasn't quite a strong religious element.
Really? Interesting.
Now, that may be because I've always lived in inner city London. Where there's quite a strong correlation between the church and local African communities, who also make up a large portion of constituency Labour parties. But I've never been in a CLP, however sort of left-leaning and trendy, that wasn't, didn't have a vocal Christian voice.
I think whatever, though, we should just be grateful we're not like the US were.
Yes.
I think even, you know, stout atheists have to pretend that they believe in God, otherwise they've got no chance of ever getting into elected office. I think there's suspicions that Obama's an atheist, but he couldn't ever possibly say that because he'd have just had no chance of probably getting any office, let alone the US president's office.
Yeah, and I think also a lot of that Obama is an atheist, Obama is a Muslim, Obama is a Seventh-day Adventist or whatever, is a code for Obama is black. And that's why I don't like him. And yeah, a lot of what he's been attacked for has, you know, basically been, I can't say I'm not going to vote for him because he's black, but I'm going to say I'm not going to vote for him for this reason that might happen to be connected to that.
Yeah, I think there is quite a lot of proxyism going on in that particular sphere, isn't there?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So we've got, I think we've covered off quite a few of the big issues that we missed over the summer.
Yeah, the only other one that I thought we might just want to talk about briefly, I'm not sure we've got that much to say about it, was just the Votes at 16 thing, which there's been a bit of campaigning about recently.
I mean, yes.
Do you think that's going to happen?
I think Labour have said that they're committed to it now. So if we win an election, then presumably we will do it.
Mm. Is this something that's been kind of bubbling under in the Labour Party for a long time? Because
of years, yeah. I can't remember a time we weren't having this right argument, and that the strength of the support for it has been rising and rising.
So, I mean, I know this is probably a bit of a facile question, but how come it didn't happen between 97 and 2010?
Because that support was rising. It wasn't overwhelming. I think it's something that each generation of politicians has got closer to. Possibly as politicians have got younger. Mm. Possibly just as our definitions and relationships to teenagers have changed. We're all a lot closer to an understanding of teenage life now, I think, in many ways, because we share... You know, you don't have to be 14 to know who One Direction are. You may have to be 14 to care, but you know who they are. I think we've got a lot. You know, culture has shifted to be a much broader spectrum, and I think that has taken into account changing attitudes towards the difference between us and them with young people.
Mm. I mean, one interesting aspect of this that I saw is that some people are trying to say that not only should votes at 16 be brought in, but the first time you're eligible to vote, it should be mandatory as well. And my understanding of the reasoning behind this is that there's research to say that people who vote the first time they're eligible to are far more likely to vote on future occasions. So it seems to be a way of trying to kind of weld in or kind of burn in the voting habit at a very young age. I think that particular aspect of it, that second part of it, is pretty misguided, because I think if someone feels like they were forced to vote the first time, but then they're not forced to vote any other time, then they'll do it the first time and then they'll think, well, I was made to do it that time. I'm not going to bother next. I think they're underestimating the willfulness of some people if they're made to do something and then given the option of not doing it later on. But also just on a kind of liberal basis, I don't think people should be forced to do it. Anyway,
well, I'm in favour of compulsory attendance at the polling station, not compulsory voting, which there is a difference. But I certainly wouldn't differentiate between a 16-year-old and a 60-year-old in those terms.
No.
I don't think you should make of that an age discrimination factor.
Yeah, I mean, I probably wouldn't be in favour of enforced attendance at a polling station either. Again, probably for liberal reasons. But whenever anyone has said to me, and it has happened quite a lot over the years, they've said, oh, I'm not voting. I can't be bothered to vote. I've had a lot of people say that to me over the years. And I always say to them, you should go down to the polling booth and you should spoil your ballot paper. At least then it gets registered that you've done something. And actually, I probably think there should be a none of the above thing. So if someone genuinely doesn't want to choose anyone, they can actively make that, make a mark that makes that clear. Because I think, although I would advise people...
Well, that's what I would get out of the compulsory attendance rather than compulsory voting. If you turn up, you sign in and say, no, I do not wish to register my vote.
So that would affect... So that would effectively be a none of the above.
Yeah,
well, I mean, I like I say, I would like there to be a none of the above. I don't really like the idea that people could end up, you know, what would the penalty be? Where would it be? A fine?
Be a fine, I would have thought, yeah.
Why, if someone doesn't pay it, do they go to prison?
Oh, I mean, no,
you know, where do you go with this?
But in terms of getting people to vote, I think our democracy is currently so damaged. And it's damaged in ways that are skewed against the people who are most reliant on the state. And I think that this is where democracy and liberalism have a real tussle. And it's which side you end up on. Do you end up on the side of democracy or do you end up on the side of liberalism?
Mm. Well, I mean, just coming back to the whole votes at 16 thing, I mean, I'd be in favour of it.
Me too.
I think it would be a good thing for younger people to be able to vote. I remember in the 1992 general election, which was in April, I was 17 and I turned 18 in July of that year, so I just missed it. And because Major ran the parliament right the way.
So you're about 6 years older than 6 months older than me. So.
Oh, well, that's been revealed now. But because Major ran the clock right down in 97 and even had a 6 week prorogement of parliament, I was almost 23 before I was able to vote the first time. Whereas if there'd been votes of 16, I'd have been able to vote. I'd been able to vote in 1992. I mean, I do wonder, though, whether at the age of 16 or 17, you're just far more likely to vote the way that your parents vote. Not that that's an illegitimate thing, and there are plenty of people who vote at older ages who still just vote the way their parents and their grandparents and so on voted, and that's up to them. I don't know if there's been any research done in that respect as to how likely people are to kind of make an independent choice at that age.
Everybody who says that doesn't seem to have met any of the 16-year-olds I know. Well, their parents did. Almost on a matter of principle.
Well, maybe. I'm pretty sure if I'd have voted in 92, I'd have voted Labour, which is the
same. I mean, I would have voted Labour and my parents voted Labour, but most of my time was spent at 16 arguing with my parents. You know, it's not a traditional 16-year-old activity agreeing with your parents.
No, and even if you were going to vote the same way as your parents, that shouldn't mean that you don't get the chance to. I mean, you know, I would extend the franchise to people in prison as well. I'm very liberal on this. I think, you know, the more people voting, really, with perhaps a few tiny exceptions, the better.
And I agree.
I think having, you know, the idea that you've got people who are 16 years old, who've left school and who are in a job and they're paying taxes, well, you know, that's taxation without representation. You know, that's a kind of fundamental Chartist principle, isn't it? So I have no problem with that at all. Having said that, you could have someone who's maybe got a very, very, very big paper round at the age of 15 or 14 who's earning enough to pay tax as well, and they don't get the vote either. So, you know, maybe once votes at 16, we may see incipient campaigns in 10 or 20 years' time for votes even younger. But again, I would take those arguments on those merits.
Yeah, absolutely. I wouldn't be at all surprised. I mean, it's like the age of consent. That is, you know, something that gets debated at various levels at various times, and it is different internationally. You know, so I think it's something like 12 in Holland, or at least it was for a while. I don't know if it still is. Whereas it's in some states in America, it's 18. You know, these things are not something that's been set to a point that we are all in agreement. We just know what's wrong when we find where it's really wrong.
Well,
so I think, for example, with age of consent, any younger than, well, I mean, I think 12 is a bit dodgy, to be frank. But, you know, younger than, say, 14 would be very hard for me to countenance.
Yeah, but I mean, I think when it comes to, like, age of consent, I think the thing that I always think about is when I was in school and, you know, I was, like, 13, 14, and, you know, the girls in my year, almost none of them were going out with lads from my year. Most of them were going out with lads 2 or 3 years older than them. And there were definitely situations where there were lads of 17, 18 going out with girls who were 14, 15, and I'm sure plenty of them were having sex. Now, technically, that's a crime. You know, you've got an adult having sex with a minor. But, I mean, that to me doesn't seem like it's the kind of thing you see plastered all over the papers about paedophilia. I mean, that doesn't seem to fit that criteria at all.
Yeah, it's just, very different.
It's children who happen to be one side of
it. I mean, I
have
my virginity younger than 16. There you go, that's a revelation for the podcast.
Sorry, you broke up slightly then, Emma. Do you just want to do that revelation again?
I said I lost my virginity earlier than 16.
Okay.
You know, as was the boy I lost it to. I don't feel that he was abusing me as a child. But we need to be conscious that the laws exist to protect children from abuse and to make sure that we get that balance right.
Yeah.
So there. Well, I think I've stunned you into silence, Mark.
I'm not sure there's any more to say on that. I pretty much agree with everything you just said. Fantastic. And I'm still staying in the Lib Dems, by the way. Just an update. So we're now at pretty much the end of the podcast. So, you know, the up Mark update, he's still in.
I'm going to do one of those websites. Is Mark still a Lib Dem?
Has Mark left the Lib Dems yet?
Yeah, that's the one. I'll do a counter.
I look forward to that.
And I, for every policy that you tell me you disagree with, I'll add it to the list.
You have to have another column of policies I agree with, though. Although at the moment, there's probably not that many. But let's gloss over that.
Okay, well, welcome home, Mark. I'm glad you had a nice holiday.
Thank you.
And thank you very much for joining me today. I'd also like to thank Audioboo for hosting the podcast and Kevin MacLeod at incompetech.com for our theme music. Hey, yo! Hey, yo! Get ready, get
Get on your feet, get into gear, and hit the street. Hey, you. Get moving, it's not too far. You're looking good, scum, as you are. Hey, you. You never know what you see when you through that door with the 7-3. Never seen nothing, no, not like this place. Never been, no, no way, not ever, no. Never seen no place, no way, similar, not like 73. Hey, you, get ready, get on your feet, get into gear, and hit the street. It's you that we want to see, so get down to 73. Get down to 73, hey, you, get down to 73.